Most days the club was half empty, and the workers, many of whom were musicians themselves, hoping to be seen by the kind of people who could make their careers, quit before the club was even 6 months old. It wasn't long before Sonny became head bartender. "Give me a whiskey," a muffled voice called to Sonny one night. He could tell it was a woman's voice, but he couldn't see her face. She was sitting all the way down at the end of the bar, and her head was in her hands. "Can't serve you if I can't see you," he said, and slowly she lifted her head. "Why don't you come on down here and get your drink?" He had never seen a woman move that slowly. It was like she had to wade through deep and mucky waters to get to him. She couldn't have been more than 19 years old, but she moved like a world-weary old woman, like sudden movements would break her bones. And when she plopped herself down on the stool in front of him, she still seemed in no hurry. "Long day?" Sonny asked. She smiled. "Ain't all days long?" Sonny got her the drink, and she sipped it just as slowly as she had done everything else. "My name's Sonny," he said. She slipped him another smile, and her eyes grew amused. "Amani Zulima." Sonny chuckled. "What kind of name is that?" he asked. "Mine." She stood up, and with the same slow stroll took her drink across the bar and up onto the stage. The band that had been playing seemed to bow before her. Without Amani needing to say anything at all, the pianist stood up to give her the stool, and the others cleared the stage. She set her drink on top of the piano and started running her hands along the keys. Here, on the piano, was the same lack of urgency that Sonny had noticed before, just fingers lazily ambling along. It was when she started singing that the room grew really quiet. She was a small woman, but her voice was so deep, it made her look much larger. There was a gravelly quality to the sound, too, like she had been gargling with pebbles to prepare herself. She swayed while she sang. First one way, then a cock of the head before moving the other way. When she started to scat, the small crowd grunted and moaned and even shouted, "Amen," once or twice. A few people came in off the street and stood in the doorway, just trying to catch sight of her. She ended in a hum, a sound that seemed to come from the fullest part of her gut, where some said the soul lived. It reminded Sonny of his childhood, of the first day his mother sang out in church. He was young, and Josephine was just a baby bopping on Eli's knee. His mother had dropped her songbook on the ground, and the whole congregation had been startled by the noise, looking up at her. Sonny felt his heart catch in his throat. He remembered that he had been embarrassed for her. Back then, he was always angry at or embarrassed by her. But then she had started to sing. "I shall wear a crown," she sang. "I shall wear a crown." It was the most beautiful thing Sonny had ever heard, and he loved his mother then, like he had never loved her before. The congregation said, "Sing, Willie," and "Amen," and "Bless God." And it seemed to Sonny then that his mother didn't have to wait for heaven for her reward. He could see it. She was already wearing her crown. Amani finished her humming and smiled at the crowd as they started to roar with clapping and praise. She picked her drink up from the top of the piano and drank it all the way down. She walked back towards Sonny and set the empty glass in front of him. She didn't say another word as she made her way out. Sonny was staying in some projects on the east side with some folks he kind of knew. Against his better judgment, he had given his mother his address, and he knew she had given it to Lucille when the woman showed up holding his daughter. "Sonny!" she shouted. She was standing on the sidewalk outside the apartment building. There could have been upwards of 100 Sonnies in Harlem. He didn't want to admit that this one was him. "Carson Clifton, I know you up there." There was no back door to the apartment, and it would only be a matter of time before Lucille figured out a way up. Sonny leaned the top half of his body out of his third-floor window.
"What you want, Luce?" he asked.
He hadn't seen his daughter in nearly a year. The child was big, too big to be cocked against her tiny mother's hip. But Lucille had always had strength enough to spare.
"Come let us up,"
she hollered back, and he sighed one of what Josephine called his old lady sighs before going down to get them. Lucille wasn't in the room but 10 seconds before Sonny regretted letting her in. "We need money, Sonny. I know my mama been paying you. What am I supposed to feed this child? Air? Air can't grow a child. I ain't got nothing for you, Lucille. You got this apartment. Angela told me you gave her something just last month." Sonny shook his head. The lies these women told each other and themselves. "I ain't seen Angela in longer than I seen you." Lucille harumphed. "What kind of father are you?" Sonny was angry now. He hadn't wanted any children, but somehow he had ended up with 3. The first was Angela's girl, the second Rhonda's, and the third was Lucille's girl, who had come out a little slow. His mother gave them all some money each month, even though he had told her to stop and told each of his women to stop asking her. They didn't listen. When Angela had given birth to their daughter, Etta, Sonny was only 15 years old. Angela was only 14. They'd said they were going to get married and do things the right way, but when Angela's parents found out she was pregnant and that the baby was Sonny's, they'd sent her down to Alabama to stay with her family there until the baby was born. And then they wouldn't let him see either girl when Angela came back up. Sonny really had wanted to do right by Angela, by his daughter. But he was young and unemployed, and he figured Angela's parents were probably right when they said he was basically good for nothing. It nearly broke his heart the day Angela married a young pastor who worked the revival circuits down south. The pastor would leave Angela in Harlem for months at a time, and Sonny thought if he could have her, he would never leave her. But then he'd look at himself in the mirror sometimes, and he'd see features he didn't recognize from his mother's face. His nose wasn't hers, nor were his ears. He used to ask his mother about these features when he was young. He used to ask her where his nose, his ears, his lighter skin came from. He used to ask her about his father, and all she would say was that he didn't have a father. He didn't have a father, but he had turned out all right. "Right?" he would tease the man in the mirror. "Right? She ain't even a baby no more, Lucille. Look at her." The girl was hobbling around the apartment on her little sea legs. Lucille shot Sonny a killing look, snatched the child up, and left. "And don't go calling my mama for money now, neither," he shouted after her. He could hear her stomping all the way down the stairs and out into the street. 2 days later, Sonny was back at Jasmine. He had asked the other folks who worked there when Imani would be back, but none of them knew. "She go where the wind blow," Blind Lewis said, wiping down the bar. Sonny must have sighed a little, because soon Lewis said, "I know that sound." "What sound?" "You don't want none, Sonny." "Why not?" Sonny asked. What could an old blind man possibly know about wanting a woman just from the sight of her? "Ain't just about the way a woman look. You got to think about what's in 'em, too," Lewis answered, reading his mind. "Ain't nothing in that woman worth wanting." Sonny didn't listen. It took 3 more months for him to see Imani again, By that time, he'd gone looking for her, dropping in at club after club, waiting to see some slow stroll make its way up to the stage. When he found her, she was sitting at a table in the back of the club, sleeping. He had to get close to know this, so close he could hear the inhale and exhale of her breath as she snored. He looked around the room, but Amani was in a dark corner of the bar, and no one seemed to be looking for her. He pushed her arm. Nothing. He pushed her arm again, harder this time. Still nothing. On the third push, she rolled her head to one side so slowly it was like a boulder moving. She blinked a couple of times, a slow, deliberate movement that brought her heavy lids and thick eyelashes together. When she looked at him finally, Sunny could see why she might need to blink. Her eyes were bloodshot, the pupils dilated. She blinked twice more, this time quickly, and watching her, it suddenly occurred to Sunny that he hadn't considered what he would do once he'd found her. "You singing tonight?" he asked meekly. "Do it look like I'm singing?" Sunny didn't answer. Amani started to stretch her neck and shoulders. She shook her whole body out. "What do you want, man?" she asked, seeing him again. "What do you want?" "You," Sunny admitted. He had wanted her since the day he saw her sing. It wasn't her slow gait or the fact that her voice had reminded him of his favorite memory of his mother. It was that he had felt something in himself open up when she started singing that night, and he wanted to capture just a little bit more of that feeling, keep it for himself. She shook her head at him and smiled a little. "Well, come on." They went out into the street. Sonny's stepfather, Eli, liked to walk, and when he was around, he used to take Sonny and Willie and Josephine all around town. Maybe that was how his mother had grown to like walking, too, Sonny thought. He still remembered the day that she had walked with him all the way down into the white part of the city. He'd thought they would keep on going forever and ever. But she had stopped suddenly, and Sonny found himself disappointed, though he hadn't been able to figure out why. With Amani, Sonny passed by places he knew from his days on the housing team. Jazz joints for the down and out, cheap food stands, barbershops. All with junkies on the street holding hats outstretched in their hands. "You ain't told me about your name yet," Sonny said as they stepped over a man lying in the middle of the street.
"What you want to know?"
"You Muslim?" Amani laughed at him a little.
"No, I ain't Muslim."
Sonny waited for her to speak. He had already said enough. He didn't want to keep pressing her, showing her his desire, his weaknesses. He waited for her to speak. "Amani means harmony in Swahili. When I started singing, I felt like I needed a new name. My mama named me Mary, and ain't nobody gonna hit it big with a name like Mary. And I ain't into all that Nation of Islam and back to Africa business. But I saw Amani, and I felt like it was mine. So I took it." "You ain't into that back to Africa business, but you're using an African name?" Sonny had put his politics behind him, but could feel them creeping up. Amani was nearly half his age. The America she was born into was different from the one he had been born into. He resisted the urge to wag his finger at her.
"We can't go back, can we?"
She stopped walking and touched his arm. She looked more serious than she had all night, like she was only just considering that he was a real person, and not someone she had dreamed up when he found her asleep.
"We can't go back to something we ain't never been to in the first place. It ain't ours anymore. This is."
She swept her hand in front of her, as though she were trying to catch all of Harlem in it, all of New York, all of America. They finally got to a housing project way out in West Harlem. The building wasn't locked, and when they entered the hallway, the first thing Sonny noticed was the row of dope fiends lining the walls. They looked like dummies, or like the corpse Sonny had seen when he walked into a funeral home to find the mortician manipulating a body, hooking the elbow up, turning the face left, bending the body at its back. No one was manipulating these bodies in the hallway. No one that Sonny could see. But he knew immediately that it was a dope house. And suddenly, what he hadn't wanted to know about Imani's slow, sleepy movements, her dilated pupils, became all too apparent. He grew nervous, but swallowed it down, because it was important to him that Imani not see that the longer he was with her, the more he began to feel that he had no control over himself. They entered a room. A man cradling his own body, curled up against the wall on a dirty mattress. Two women were tapping their arms, readying themselves for the needle a second man was holding. They didn't even look up as Sonny and Imani entered. Everywhere he looked, Sonny saw jazz instruments. Two horns, a bass, a sax. Imani set her things down and sat next to one of the girls who finally looked up, nodded at them. Imani turned to Sonny, who was still hanging back, his hand still grazing the doorknob. She didn't say anything. The man passed the needle to the first girl. That girl passed the needle to the second. The second passed the needle to Imani, but she was still looking at Sonny. She was still silent. Sonny watched her plunge the needle into her arm, watched her eyes roll back. When she looked at him again, she didn't have to speak for him to hear her say, "This is me. You still want it?" "Carson! Carson, I know you in there." He could hear the voice, but at the same time he couldn't hear it. He was living in his own head, and he could not tell where that ended and where the world began. And he didn't want to answer the voice until he was sure he knew which side of things it was coming from. "Carson!" He sat quietly, or at least what he thought was quietly. He was sweating. His chest was heaving up and down, up and down. He would need to go score soon to keep himself from dying. When the voice outside the door started praying, Sonny knew it was his mother. She had done it a few times before, when he was still mostly sober, when dope was still mostly fun, and he felt like he had some control over it. "Lord, release my son from this torment. Father God, I know he done gone down to hell to take a look, but please send him back." Sonny might have found it soothing if he weren't feeling so sick. He heaved. Nothing at first. But soon he was vomiting in the corner of the room. His mother's voice grew louder. "Lord, I know you can deliver him from what ails him. Bless him and keep him." Deliverance was exactly what Sonny wanted. He was a 45-year-old dope fiend, and he was tired, but he was also sick. And the sickness of trying to come off the dope outweighed his exhaustion with staying on it every single time. His mother was whispering now. Or maybe Sonny's ears were no longer working. Soon he couldn't hear anything at all. Before long, somebody would be home. One of the other fiends he lived with would come in, and maybe they would have scored something. But probably they wouldn't have. And Sonny would have to begin the ritual of trying to score himself. Instead, he began it now. He pushed himself up off the ground and put his ear against the door to make certain his mother had gone. Once he knew, he went out to greet Harlem. Harlem and heroin. Heroin and Harlem. Sonny could no longer think of one without thinking of the other. They sounded alike. Both were going to kill him. The junkies and the jazz had gone together, fed each other, and now every time Sonny heard a horn, he wanted a hit. Sonny walked down 116th Street. He could almost always score on 116th Street, and he had trained himself to spot junkies and dealers as quickly as possible, letting his eyes scan the folks walking by until they landed on the people who had what he needed. It was a consequence of living inside his own head. It made him aware of others who were doing the same thing. When Sonny came across the first junkie, he asked if she was holding, and the woman shook her head. When he came across the second one, he asked if he would let him carry, and the man shook his head too, but pointed him along to a guy who was dealing. Sonny's mother didn't give him money anymore. Angela sometimes did, if her Bible-slinging husband had made some extra cash on the revival circuit. Sonny gave the dealer every last dollar he had, and it bought him so little. It bought him next to nothing. He wanted to shoot it before going back, just in case Imani was there. She would take him for the next to nothing he had. Sonny went into the bathroom of a diner and shot up, and instantly he could feel the sickness moving away from him. By the time he made it back home, he felt almost well. Almost, which meant that he would have to score again soon to get a little closer, and again to get a little closer, and again, and again. Imani sat in front of a mirror, braiding her hair. "Where you been?" she asked. Sonny didn't answer. He wiped his nose with the back of his hand and started rummaging around the fridge for food. They lived in the Johnson houses on 112th and Lexington, and their door was never locked. Junkies came and went from one apartment to the next. Someone was passed out on the floor in front of the table. "Your mama was here," Imani said. Sonny found a piece of bread and ate around the mold. He looked at Imani as she finished her hair and stood up to look at herself. She was getting thick around the middle. "She says she wants you to come home for Sunday dinner." "Where are you going?" he asked Imani. He didn't like it when she got dressed up. She had promised him a long time ago that she would never give up her body for dope, and in the beginning, Sonny hadn't believed she would be able to keep her promise. A dope fiend's word didn't count for much. Sometimes, for assurance, he would follow her as she walked around Harlem on those nights when she did her hair up, put makeup on her face. Every time he did, it ended the same sad way. Imani begging a club owner to let her sing again, just once more. They almost never did. One time, the dingiest joint in all of Harlem had said yes, and Sonny had stood in the back as Imani got up on stage to blank stares and silence. Nobody remembered what she used to be. All they could see was what she was now.
"You should go see your mama, Sonny. We could use some money."
"Oh, come on, Imani. You know she ain't gonna give me nothing."
"She might. If you cleaned yourself up, you could use a shower and a shave. She might give you something."
Sonny went up to Imani. He stood behind her and wrapped his arms around her belly, felt the firmness of its weight.
"Why don't you give me something, baby?"
he whispered into her ear. She started to wriggle, but he held firm, and she softened, leaned into him. Sonny had never loved her, not really, but he had always wanted her. It took him a while to learn the difference between those two things.
"I just did my hair, Sonny," she said,
but she was already offering him her neck, bending it to the left so that he could run his tongue along the right side.
"Sing me a little something, Imani," he said, reaching for her breast.
She hummed at his touch, but didn't sing. Sonny let his hand wander down from her breast, down to meet the tufts of hair that awaited him. Then she started.
"I loves you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad."
She sang so softly it was almost a whisper. Almost. By the time his fingers found her wet, she was back at the chorus. When she left that night to go out to the jazz clubs, they wouldn't let her sing. But Sonny always did. "I'll go see my mama," he promised when she left the front door swinging. Sonny kept a glassine bag of dope in his shoe. It was a reassurance. He walked the many blocks between his house and his mother's house with his big toe clenched around the bag as though it were a small fist. He'd clench it, then release it. Clench it, then release it. As Sonny passed the projects that filled the distance between his apartment and Willie's, he tried to remember the last time he'd really spoken to his mother. It was 1964, during the riots, and she had asked him to meet her in front of her church so that she could lend him some money. "I don't want to see you dead or worse," she'd said, passing Sonny what little change hadn't made it into the offering plate. As he took the money, Sonny had wondered, what could be worse than dead? But all around him the evidence was clear. Only weeks before, the NYPD had shot down a 15-year-old black boy, a student, for next to nothing. The shooting had started the riots, pitting young black men and some black women against the police force. The news made it sound like the fault lay with the blacks of Harlem. The violent, the crazy, the monstrous black people who had the gall to demand that their children not be gunned down in the streets. Sonny clutched his mother's money tight as he walked back that day, hoping he wouldn't run into any white people looking to prove a point, because he knew in his body, even if he hadn't yet put it together in his mind, that in America, the worst thing you could be was a black man. Worse than dead, you were a dead man walking. Josephine answered the door. She cradled her baby girl in one arm, and her son held her other hand. "You get lost or something?" she asked, shooting him a dirty look. "Behave," his mother hissed from behind her, but Sonny was glad to see his sister treating him the same way she always had. "You hungry?" Willie asked. She took the baby from Josephine and started walking toward the kitchen. "I'm gonna use the bathroom first," Sonny said. Already making his way over, he closed the door and sat on the commode, pulling the bag from his shoe. He hadn't been there a minute, but he was already nervous. He needed something to tide him over. When he came back out, his mother had already fixed him a plate. His mother and sister watched him while he ate. "Why you ain't eatin'?" he asked them. "Because you about an hour and a half late," Josephine said through gritted teeth. Willie put an arm on Josephine's shoulder, then pulled a little money out from inside her bra. "Josie, why don't you run go get these kids something?" she said. The look Josephine sent Willie hurt Sonny more than anything she had said to him yet. It was a look that asked if Willie would be safe left alone with him. And the uncertain nod Willie gave back just about broke Sonny's heart. Josephine collected her children and left. Sonny had never seen the baby before, though his mother had come to tell him about the birth. The toddler Sonny had seen once, when he passed Josephine on a quiet street one day. He'd kept his head down and pretended not to see them. "Thanks for the food, Mama," Sonny said. He was almost finished with his food, and he was starting to feel a little sick from eating so fast. She nodded and heaped another helping onto his plate. "How long it been since you ate something proper?" she asked. Sonny shrugged, and his mother continued to watch him. He was uncomfortable again. The small hit he took was wearing off too quickly, and he wanted to excuse himself to go do more. But too many trips to the bathroom would only make her suspicious. "Your father was a white man," Willie said calmly. Sonny nearly choked on the chicken bone he had been working over. "You used to ask me about him long time ago, and I ain't never told you nothing." so I'm telling you now. She got up to pour a glass from the pitcher of tea she kept by the sink. She drank the whole glass of tea while Sonny watched her back. When she finished that glass, she poured herself another and took it back to the table. "He didn't start out white," she said. "He was black when I met him, more yellow than black, really. But still, he was colored." Sonny coughed. He started fingering the chicken bone. "Why you ain't told me before?" he asked. He could feel himself getting angry, but he held it back. He had come here for money, and he couldn't fight with her now. Not now.
"I thought about telling you. I did.
You saw him once.
Day we walked all the way to West 109th Street. You remember that? Your daddy was standing across the street with his white woman and his white baby, and I thought maybe I should tell Carson who that man is. But then I figured it'd be better just to let him go. So I let him go, and we went back to Harlem."
Sonny snapped the chicken bone in half.
"Mama, you should have stopped him. You should have told me, and you should have stopped him. I don't know why you always letting people walk all over you. My father, Eli, the goddamn church. You ain't never fought for nothing. Not nothing. Not a day in your life."
His mother reached across the table, put her hand on his shoulder, and squeezed hard until he had to look her in the eyes.
"That ain't true, Carson. I fought for you."
He returned his eyes to the two pieces of chicken bone on his plate. He towed the bag in his shoe.
"You think you done something 'cause you used to march?"
"I marched.
I marched with your father and with my little baby all the way up from Alabama, all the way to Harlem. My son was going to see a better world than what I saw, what my parents saw. I was going to be a famous singer. Robert wasn't going to have to work in a mine for some white man. That was a march, too, Carson."
Sonny started looking toward the bathroom. He wanted to excuse himself and finish up the bag in his shoe. He knew it would probably be the last he could afford for a long, long while. Willie cleared his plate and refilled her tea. He could see her standing at the sink, drinking in long, deep breaths, her chest and back rising and falling as she tried to collect herself. She came back and sat down right in front of him, looking at him all the while.
"You was always so angry. Even as a child, you was angry. I used to see you looking at me like you was like to kill me, and I didn't know why. Took me a long time to figure out that you was born to a man who could choose his life, but you wouldn't never be able to choose yours. And it seemed like you was born knowing that."
She took a sip of her drink and stared off into space.
"White men get a choice. They get to choose their job, choose their house. They get to make black babies, then disappear into thin air, like they wasn't never there to begin with, like these black women they slept with or raped done laid on top of themselves and got pregnant. White men get to choose for black men, too. Used to sell them. Now they just send them to prison like they did my daddy, so that they can't be with their kids. Just about breaks my heart to see you, my son. My daddy's grandson, over here with these babies walking up and down Harlem who barely even know your name, let alone your face. All's I can think is this ain't the way it's supposed to be. There are things you ain't learned from me. Things you picked up from your father, even though you ain't know him. Things he picked up from white men. It makes me sad to see my son a junkie after all the marching I've done. But makes me sadder to see you thinking you can leave
like your daddy did. You keep doing what you're doing, and the white man don't got to do it no more. He ain't got to sell you or put you in a coal mine to own you. He'll own you just as is, and he'll say you the one who did it. He'll say it's your fault. Josephine came back in with the kids. They had ice cream smeared on their shirts and contented little smiles on their faces. Josephine didn't wait to hear more. She just took the kids straight into the bedroom to lay them down to sleep. Willie pulled a wad of cash out from between her breasts and slapped it on the table in front of him. "This what you came for?" she asked. Sonny could see tears forming in her eyes. He kept towing the glassine bag, his fingers itching to get at the money. "Take it and go if you want to," Willie said. "Go if you want to." What Sonny wanted was to scream, to take the money, take what was left in the bag in his shoe and find somewhere to go shoot up until he could no longer remember the things his mother had told him. That was what he wanted to do. But he didn't do that. Instead, he stayed. Marjorie.
"Excuse me, sister. I take you see castle. Cape Coast Castle. 5 cities. You come from America. I take you see slave ship. Just 5 cities.
The boy was probably around 10 years old, only a few years younger than Marjorie herself was. He had been following her since she and her grandmother's housekeeper got off the Trocho. The locals did this, waiting for tourists to disembark so that they could con them into paying for things Ghanaians knew were free. Marjorie tried to ignore him, but she was hot and tired, still feeling the sweat of the other people who had been pressed against her back and chest and sides on the nearly 8-hour Trocho ride from Accra.
"I take you see Cape Coast Castle, sis. Just 5 cities.
He repeated. He wore no shirt, and she could feel the heat radiating off of his skin coming toward her. After all the traveling, she couldn't stand another strange body so near hers, and so she soon found herself shouting in Twi. "I'm from Ghana, stupid, can't you see?" The boy didn't stop his English. "But you come from America." Angry, she kept walking. Her backpack straps were heavy against her shoulders, and she knew they would leave marks. Marjorie was in Ghana visiting her grandmother, as she did every summer. Some time ago, the woman had moved to Cape Coast to be near the water. In Ejiso, where she had lived before, everyone called her Crazy Woman. But in Cape Coast, they knew her only as Old Lady. So old, they said, she could recite the entire history of Ghana from memory alone.
"Is that my child coming to me?" the woman asked.
She was leaning on a cane made of curved wood, and her back mimicked that curve, rounding down so that the woman looked like she was in constant supplication.
"Akwaba! Akwaba! Akwaba!" she said. "My old lady, I've missed you," Marjorie said.
She hugged her grandmother too forcefully, and the woman yelped.
"Eh! You come to break me? Sorry, sorry."
Old lady called her houseboy to take Marjorie's bag, and slowly, gingerly, Marjorie pulled the straps from her aching shoulders. Her grandmother saw her wince and asked, "Are you hurt?" "It's nothing." The response was a reflex. Whenever her father or grandmother asked her about pain, Marjorie would say she had never known it. As a young child, someone had told her that the scars her father wore on his face and her grandmother on her hands and feet were born of great pain. And because Marjorie had no scars that resembled those, she could never bring herself to complain of pain. Once, when she was just a little girl, she had watched a ringworm on her knee grow and grow and grow. She'd hidden it from her parents for nearly 2 weeks, until the worm overtook the curve where thigh met calf, making it difficult for her to bend. When she'd finally shown her parents, her mother had vomited, and her father had snatched her in his arms and rushed her to the emergency room. The orderly who came to call them back had been startled, not by the worm, but by her father's scar. She'd asked if he was the one who needed help. Looking at her grandmother's hands now, it was almost impossible to distinguish scarred from wrinkled skin. The whole landscape of the woman's body had transformed into a ruin. The young woman had been toppled, leaving this. They took a cab back to old lady's house. Marjorie's grandmother lived in a big, open bungalow on the beach, like the kind the few white people who lived in town had. When Marjorie was in third grade, her father and mother had left Alabama and returned to Ghana in order to help old lady build it. They stayed for many months, leaving Marjorie in the care of a friend of theirs. When summer came and Marjorie was finally able to go visit them, she fell in love with the beautiful house with no doors. It was 5 times the size of her family's tiny apartment in Huntsville, and its front yard was the beach. Not a sad slab of dying grass like the yard she'd always known. She spent that whole summer wondering how her parents could leave a place like this. "Have you been good, my own child?" old lady asked, handing Marjorie some of the chocolate she kept in the kitchen. Marjorie had a sweet tooth reserved for chocolate. Her mother often joked that Marjorie must have been birthed from a coconut, split open and wide. Marjorie nodded, accepting the treat. "Are we going to the water today?" she asked, her mouth full, the chocolate melting. "Speak tree," her grandmother answered sharply, knocking Marjorie on the back of her head. "Sorry," Marjorie mumbled. At home in Huntsville, her parents spoke to her in tree, and she answered them in English. They had done this since the day Marjorie had brought a note home from her kindergarten teacher. The note read, "Marjorie does not volunteer to answer questions. She rarely speaks. Does she know English? If she doesn't, you should consider English as a second language classes. Or perhaps Marjorie would benefit from special care. We have great special ed classes here." Her parents were livid. Her father read the note aloud 4 times, shouting, "What does this foolish woman know?" after each repetition. But from then on, they had quizzed Marjorie on her English every night. When she tried to answer their questions in tree, they would say, "Speak English." Until now, it was the first language that popped into her head. She had to remind herself that her grandmother required the opposite. "Yes, we will go to the water now. Put away your things." Going to the beach with old lady was one of Marjorie's favorite things in the world to do. Her grandmother was not like other grandmothers. At night, old lady spoke in her sleep. Sometimes she fought. Sometimes she paced the room. Marjorie had heard the stories about the burns her grandmother carried on her hands and feet, about the one on her father's face. She knew why the Ajiso people had called her crazy woman. But to her, her grandmother had never been crazy. Old lady dreamed dreams and saw visions. They walked to the beach. Old lady moved so slowly, it was like she wasn't moving at all. Neither of them wore shoes, and when they got to the edge of the sand, they waited for the water to come up and lick the spaces between their toes, clean the sand that was hidden there. Marjorie watched as her grandmother closed her eyes, and she waited patiently for the old woman to speak. It was what they had come for, what they always came for. "Are you wearing the stone?" her grandmother asked. Instinctively, Marjorie raised her hand to the necklace. Her father had given it to her only a year before, saying that she was finally old enough to care for it. It had belonged to old lady and to Abena before her, and to James, and Quay, and Ephia the beauty before that. It had begun with Mame, the woman who had set a great fire. Her father had told her that the necklace was a part of their family history, and she was to never take it off, never give it away. Now it reflected the ocean water before them, gold waves shimmering in the black stone. "Yes, old lady," she said. Her grandmother took her hand, and once more they fell silent. "You are in this water," she finally said. Marjorie nodded her head soberly. The day she was born, 13 years ago, all the way across the Atlantic, her parents had mailed her umbilical cord to Old Lady so that the woman could put it into the ocean. It was Old Lady's only request that if her son and daughter-in-law, both old themselves by the time they decided to get married and move to America, ever had a child, they would send something of that child back to Ghana.
"Our family began here, in Cape Coast," Old Lady said. She pointed to the Cape Coast castle. "In my dreams, I kept seeing this castle, but I did not know why. One day I came to these waters and I could feel the spirits of our ancestors calling to me. Some were free, and they spoke to me from the sand. But some others were trapped deep, deep, deep in the water so that I had to wade out to hear their voices. I waded out so far, the water almost took me down to meet those spirits that were trapped so deep in the sea that they would never be free. When they were living, they had not known where they came from, and so dead they did not know how to get to dry land. I put you in here so that if your spirit ever wandered, you would know where home was."
Marjorie nodded as her grandmother took her hand and walked her farther and farther out into the water. It was their summer ritual, her grandmother reminding her how to come home. Marjorie returned to Alabama 3 shades darker and 5 pounds heavier. Her period had come while she was with her grandmother, and the old woman had clapped her hands and sang songs to celebrate Marjorie's womanhood. She didn't want to leave Cape Coast, but school was starting and her parents wouldn't let her stay any longer. She was entering high school, and while she had always hated Alabama, the newer, bigger school had instantly reminded her of why. Her family lived on the southeast side of Huntsville. They were the only black family on the block, the only black people for miles and miles and miles. At her new high school, there were more black children than Marjorie was used to seeing in Alabama. But it took only a few conversations with them for Marjorie to realize that they were not the same kind of black that she was. That indeed, she was the wrong kind.
"Why you talk like that?"
Tisha, the leader of the pack, had asked her the first day of high school when she joined them for lunch.
"Like what?"
Marjorie asked, and Tisha had repeated it, her accent turning almost British in order to capture her impression of Marjorie.
"Like what?"
The next day, Marjorie sat by herself, reading Lord of the Flies for English class. She held the book in one hand and a fork in the other. She was so engrossed in the book that she didn't realize that the chicken she had pierced with her fork hadn't made it into her mouth until she tasted air. She finally looked up to see Tisha and the other black girls staring at her.
"Why are you reading that book?"
Tisha asked. Marjorie stammered,
I have to read it for class." "I have to read it for class,"
Tisha mimicked.
"You sound like a white girl. White girl, white girl, white girl."
They kept chanting, and it was all Marjorie could do to keep from crying. In Ghana, whenever a white person appeared, there was always a child there to point him out. A small group of children, dark and shiny in the equatorial sun, would extend their fingers toward the person whose skin was different from theirs and shout, "Obroni! Obroni!" They would giggle, delighted by the difference. When Marjorie had first seen children do this, she'd watched as the white man whose skin color had been told to him grew shocked, offended.
"Why do they keep saying that?"
he'd asked the friend who was showing him around. Marjorie's father pulled her aside that night and asked her if she knew the answer to the white man's question. And she had shrugged. Her father had told her that the word had come to mean something entirely different from what it used to mean. That the young of Ghana, itself an infant country, had been born to a place emptied of its colonizers. Because they didn't see white men every day the way people of his mother's generation and older had, the word could take on a new meaning for them. They lived in a Ghana where they were the majority, where theirs was the only skin color for miles around. To them, to call someone Obroni was an innocent act, an interpretation of race as skin color. Now, keeping her head down and fighting back tears as Tisha and her friends called her white girl, Marjorie was made aware yet again that here, white could be the way a person talked. Black, the music a person listened to. In Ghana, you could only be what you were, what your skin announced to the world. "Don't mind them," Marjorie's mother, Esther, said that night as she stroked Marjorie's hair. "Don't mind them, my smart girl, my beautiful girl." The next day, Marjorie ate lunch in the English teacher's lounge. Her teacher, Mrs. Pinkston, was a fat, walnut-skinned woman with a laugh that sounded like the slow build of an approaching train. She carried a large pink handbag that she would pull books out of unendingly, like a magician's hat. In her head, Marjorie called the books rabbits.
"What do they know?"
Mrs. Pinkston said, passing Marjorie a cookie.
"They don't know a thing."
Mrs. Pinkston was Marjorie's favorite teacher, one of two black teachers in a school that served almost 2,000 students. She was the only person Marjorie knew who had a copy of her father's book, "The Ruin of a Nation Begins in the Homes of Its People." The book was her father's life work. He was 63 when he finished it, approaching 70 when he and her mother finally had her. He'd taken the title from an old Ashanti proverb and used it to discuss slavery and colonialism. Marjorie, who had read every book on her family's bookshelves, had once spent an entire afternoon trying to read her father's book. She'd only made it to page 2. When she told her father this, he'd said that it was something she wouldn't understand until she was much older. He said that people need time in order to be able to see things clearly.
"What do you think about the book?"
Mrs. Pinkston said, pointing to the copy of Lord of the Flies that dangled from Marjorie's hands.
"I like it," Marjorie said. "But do you love it? Do you feel it inside you?"
Marjorie shook her head. She didn't know what it meant to feel a book inside of her. But she didn't want to tell her English teacher that, lest it disappoint her. Mrs. Pinkston laughed her moving train laugh, leaving Marjorie to her reading. And so Marjorie spent 3 years this way, searching for books that she loved, that she could feel inside of her. By senior year, she had read almost everything on the south wall of the school's library, at least 1,000 books, and she was working her way through the north wall. That's a good one. She had just brought down Middlemarch from the shelf and was taking in the smell of the book when the boy spoke to her.
"You like Eliot?" Marjorie asked.
She had seen him around recently, but she couldn't quite remember where. With blonde hair and blue eyes, he looked like a little boy she'd seen in a Cheerios commercial once, now grown up. He put his index finger to his lips.
"Don't tell anyone," he said, and she smiled despite herself. My name's Marjorie.
Graham.
They shook hands, and Graham told her about Pigeon Feathers, the book he was reading. He told her that his family had just moved there from Germany, that his father was in the military, that his mother had died long ago. Marjorie must have spoken too, but she couldn't remember what she had said, only that she had smiled so much her cheeks ached. Before they knew it, the bell rang and lunch hour was over and they went on to their next class. From then on, they saw each other every day. They read together in the library while everyone else ate lunch. They sat only inches apart at a big, long table that could have seated 30 or more, the many empty seats giving them no excuse to explain their proximity. They stopped talking as much as they had that first day. Reading together was enough. Sometimes Graham would leave a note with his own writing for Marjorie to find. They were mostly little poems or fragmented stories. She was too shy to show him the things that she had written. At night, when she went home, she would wait for her parents to go to bed before turning on her lamp to read Graham's notes in the soft light. "Daddy, when did you know you liked Mama?" she asked at breakfast the next day. Her father had suffered from a heart attack 2 years before, and now ate a bowl of oatmeal every day. He was so old that Marjorie's teachers always assumed he was her grandfather. He wiped his lips with his napkin and cleared his throat.
"Who told you I like your mother?" he asked.
Marjorie rolled her eyes as her father started to laugh.
"Did your mother tell you that?"
Abronama, you are too young to like anyone. Concentrate on your studies."
He was out the door, headed to teach his history course at the community college, before Marjorie could protest. She had always hated it when her father called her Dove. It was her special name, the nickname born with her because of her Ashanti name. But it had always made Marjorie feel small somehow, young and fragile. She was not small. She was not young either. She was old, so old her breasts had grown to the size of her mother's. So large, she sometimes had to carry them in her hands when walking naked through her bedroom to keep them from slapping against her chest.
"Who do you like?" Marjorie's mother asked, coming into the room with fresh laundry in her hands.
Though her parents had lived in America for nearly 15 years, Esther still would not use a washing machine. She washed all the family's undergarments by hand in the kitchen sink.
"No one," Marjorie said.
"Has someone come to ask you to prom?" Esther asked, grinning widely.
Marjorie sighed. 5 years ago, she had watched a 2020 special on proms across America with her mother, and her mother had been delighted by it. She said that she had never seen anything like the girls in their long dresses and the boys in their suits. The thought that her daughter could be one of those special girls was a hope that flickered like light in Esther's eye, just as it stung like dust in Marjorie's. Marjorie was one of 30 black people at her school. None of them had been asked to the prom the year before.
"No, Mama, God."
"I am not God, and I have never been," her mother said, pulling a lacy black bra from the depths of the sink water. "If a boy likes you, you have to make it known that you like him too. Otherwise, he will never do anything. I lived in your father's house for many, many years before he asked me to marry him. I was a foolish girl, hoping he would see that I wanted the same thing he did, without ever making it known. Were it not for old lady's intervention, who knows if he would have ever done anything? That woman has strong powers of will." That night, Marjorie tucked Graham's poem under her pillow, hoping she had inherited her grandmother's willpower, that the words he'd written would float up into her ear as she slept, blossom into a dream.
Mrs. Pinkston was putting on a black cultural event for the school,
and she asked Marjorie if she would read a poem. The event, called The Waters We Wade In, was unlike anything the school had ever done before, and it was to take place at the beginning of May, well after Black History.